It's an honor for me to come after Angela Davis because the struggle of black people in this country was an inspiration throughout the world, including in India. Let me thank the organizers for inviting me, and I also bring you greetings from the Coalition for Nuclear Disarmament and Peace, which was formed after the nuclear weapons test in India and is part of the international movement not only against nuclear weapons but also against the US empire building and against its atrocities in Palestine, in Afghanistan and Iraq. My brief was to speak to an American audience about the situation in my country, and that's something that I will be doing later on. But I'm going to take the risk of offending many of you, perhaps, and perhaps the organizers, by not doing that, but by sharing my thoughts about your government and your society. My reason for doing this is simple. In order to defeat the US imperial project, of course, we have to fight outside the United States of America to defeat it. But we also have to fight inside the United States. And for all the difficulties that we have outside of here, we have one great advantage. And that is that there is a very widespread clarity and understanding that when we talk about the United States government's foreign policy over the so many decades, we are talking about not just an occasional bully, we are talking about a regular, brutal, and hypocritical bully. But it is my belief, rightly or wrongly, that things are not so simple within the United States. In fact, it seems to me that within the United States of America, there is a terrible disease, and it is very widespread. It spreads among young people and old people, black people and white, men and women, academics and non-academics, and it's the disease of American exceptionalism. The belief that this is the greatest and the best country in the world. And like many myths, it gets its power because it's not totally false, because there are many wonderful things about this society. But of course, it is deeply flawed, and of course creates a huge problem, because the common sense in this country, as I understand it, is that this great, this wonderful country, I mean, isn't it strange, you have this term anti-Americanism. Do we ever hear of anti-Italianism, anti-Germanism, anti-Japanesism, anti-Indianism? No, the only equivalent to this was anti-Sovietism. Because when you talked about the Soviet Union, or you talked about the United States of America, you're not supposed to be talking about some country with its combination of good things or bad things. You're supposed to be talking about some kind of extraordinary embodiment of a gift to humanity. That's what you're supposed to. And therefore, if you criticize that country or its country's foreign policies, somehow you are criticizing this wonderful gift, this ideology. And that has to be broken. Because if it is not broken, then the common sense is, well, maybe the United States, well, we did make a mistake. The United States did make a mistake in Vietnam. Maybe it's making a mistake in Iraq. But how can you doubt our intentions? How can you doubt what we really want to offer and give to the world? And this illusion must be broken. Let me start with September 11th. After September 11, 2001, there was a very widespread and deep sentiment in this country that deserves our greatest respect. And that sentiment was never again. Never again. But unfortunately, when you say never again, you can take it in two directions. You can say never again to my people, or you can say never again to any people. The problem with tragedies like the Holocaust and September 11th is that too many people in Israel and too many people in the United States of America do not say never again to any people. They do not reassert our common humanity. They say never again to my people. And that creates an emotional political reservoir which the governments of Israel and the United States of America can abuse, misuse, and manipulate in order to carry out the most brutal injustices and atrocities against other people in the name of protecting their people. There was another problem, of course, with September 11th. Apart from the moral horror, it was, of course, a profound political strategic horror and error. It was, if you like, the gift of the lowest rungs of the international reactionary right, your Al-Qaeda's. It was their gift to the most highest and powerful rungs of the international reactionary right wing, and that, of course, is the United States government. It gave them an opportunity. It gave them an excuse, an ideological cover, to carry out a long-prepared and carrying on continuous imperial project. After the end of the Cold War, if you look at the hardware of this American imperial project, it's not George Bush. You have the Clinton administration, which bears huge responsibility for carrying this hardware out. You now have over 750 bases in over 140 countries, military-related bases of one sort or the other. And of course, it's our responsibility outside to oppose these. You have a military budget which is greater than the next 25 countries put together, perhaps even greater than the rest of the world's military budgets put together. You have the attempt to consolidate a global imperial army headed by the United States, but for moral, diplomatic, and even practical military reasons, which must, of course, involve the soldiers and other countries as much as possible, because when you talk about the United States government, you're talking about a government whose capacity to kill is reaching infinity, but whose capacity to suffer casualties is very, very low, and therefore they need soldiers and all other countries. They need what has been called the coalition of the willing, or more accurately, the coalition of the coerced. And again, it is our responsibility to try and make our governments back out of this and refuse to be part of this political strategy. At the same time, if that is the hardware, there's also been the software. And I'm not just referring to the fact that in 2002, September, you had a national security strategy which for the first time rationalized and justified preventive war. I'm also talking about the fact that in the last 10 years, and the responsibility of this is not Bush, it's your Clinton, that over the last 10 years, you now have five new ideological covers for carrying out the American imperial project: humanitarian intervention. You have regime change, weapons of mass destruction, the war on global terror, and fifth, let's not forget, failed states, which can then justify the United States directly or indirectly through the United Nations making interventions in places like Africa and elsewhere. These are all five ideological covers that the United States can now use to try to push through its imperial project. But there is something very interesting. Of these five, two are more important than the others. And this seems to me is connected to the peculiarity of the United States as a country, as an advanced industrialized society with an imperial past and a present, because it's very different from Britain and France and other European countries. This is one country in which the public is much more, compared to any other advanced industrialized society, much more insular. Less than 10% have passports. Much more ignorant of the rest of society and much more indifferent. It means that there is a special responsibility on this United States government to seek to mobilize this American public for its imperial project. And of course, when you want to mobilize this American project, and when you recognize its insularity, its ignorance, and its indifference, one of the most powerful assets that you have is that you also have a much greater fearfulness within the United States of America about the rest of the world, and you have to tap into that. And that's exactly what the war on global terror and weapons of mass destruction are able to do. Yesterday, when I came in to the United States, at the immigration counter, I was asked, What did you come here for? I said, the Boston Social Forum. What are you going to do there? I said, I'm probably going to speak. What are you going to speak on? I'm probably going to speak on India and Pakistan's nuclear weapons. And this immigration official said, well, India and Pakistan nuclear weapons, no, that's not a problem. What I'm worried about is North Korea, and we're going to flatten them. But that was an expression, it seemed to me, of a kind of widespread feeling. And this is also one particular reason, because after September 11th, this war on global terror has become a very powerful ideological weapon that they can use. Let me end by just saying something about the importance of the Boston Social Forum and about how it connects to our collective struggle against the US empire. When we in New Delhi organized after the American invasion in Iraq, when we organized a demonstration of thousands, one of the young reporters from the equivalent of the New York Times, the Times of India, came up to us and said, well, what's the point of this demonstration? What have you got? The invasion has taken place. Do you really think you can stop it? And I'm afraid that that young person, like so many others, does not really understand what political struggle is all about today and what progressive politics is all about. And the uniqueness of political struggle in the last 150 years is something that I believe we must grasp. And that is that political struggle is not above all a contest of arms. It is not above all a contest of economic strength. It is a contest of wills in which one side seeks to impose its will on the other side. But what happens when the side that is weaker economically and militarily refuses to accept the imposition of the will of the other side? What happens when you talk in the last 150 years, which is the era for the first time of mass politics, of people on a mass scale coming into politics, which is why we've had the possibility of the Vietnamese defeating the Americans, of the Russians having to get out of Afghanistan, of decolonization, and so many other things. It's the entry of masses of people into politics and the creation of a collective will to resist. And when we have that collective will to resist, it creates huge problems. And what it means really is that when we talk about progressive politics, for me, what it simply means when we have these kinds of events, when we write, when we speak, when we have cultural activity, when we have our demonstrations, what we're really doing is something very simple. We are initiating, we are deepening, we are consolidating, we are spreading, we are expressing that indomitable will to resist. And as long as we are prepared to do that, as long as we recognize that throughout human history there has been the struggle for power and the struggle for justice, and they are not parallel, they move in different directions, sometimes they converge, and when they converge, of course, it's wonderful because the struggle for power is then harnessed to the ends of justice. But when they diverge, people make their choice, and there will be lots of people who will choose the struggle for power, but fortunately there are going to be lots of people who are also going to continue to struggle for justice. And the more people that struggle for justice, the more our chances of forcing that convergence, of leading towards a much better and humane world for all. Thank you very much.